When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me is Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul, what's happening?
Oh, as always.
As always, I'm Brian.
I forgot the as always.
Well, you assume that it's all I'm always.
Yes, you're always here. Yeah, you just sit by the computer until I come back.
Yeah, it's basic. Yeah, I mean, you know, I got the mic on and I'm just sitting here. I'm Fry's dog looking, waiting for him to come back.
Oh, wow. That's some serious sads you just threw in my direction.
Yep.
Well, anyway, here we
See,
are.
See, I we're do back. Know something about Futurama.
We were talking, yeah, listeners don't know that we were talking before this. But we were talking about Futurama, and Futurama has come back to Hulu after 13, 14, 15 years, something like that, which I think is glorious.
I think that's very nice. Paul and I were talking, I've watched it sporadically, but I was never a regular every week, or I've never binged the entire series. I know enough about it. I've seen plenty of episodes. I've always enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I obviously knew one episode.
I watched it on its original airing. And watched all the episodes and then rewatched it again when my daughter said, "Have you ever seen this show?" Yes, I have. And I will see it again. It became like a father-daughter bonding thing watching Futurama together.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very cool. Today on the first of all, today on the program, we'll be discussing a listener request from Emily M. Yes, Emily M made a rather good suggestion, in my opinion, of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles The Last Ronin, which I think will provide a very good conversation later.
I think it would.
So we have a few things we want to talk about. Very briefly, I wanted to touch on the ongoing writer's strike and now actor's strike in Hollywood. I guess just to vent a little bit and say, corporations, just pay your people. Why is it so hard to just pay your people? Just pay them. Why is that so hard?
Yes. and that goes to the comic industry as well. There was a hashtag movement not too long ago, like kind of heartbreaking. It's we didn't discuss it because it was too depressing, but it was about, you know, like a comic creator had died and, you know, it sparked this whole sort of running thing about people talking about how, you know, comics have, how hard it is to work in the comic book industry because of the monetary or the lack of monetary, you know, stability that they have. I mean, you know, some people, Robert Kirkman, he's okay. He's going to be all right.
Yeah, exactly.
Jonathan Hickman, it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Your Alan Morris, your Grant Morrisons.
Yeah. But like in keeping with that, like, you know, so the comic industry also is not doing real well when it comes to taking care of their, the people who work for them, and it's freelance versus exclusive. But going back to your original thing, I interrupted your rant. I apologize.
That's all right. You know, and I mean, it's a bummer for us, you know, the layman. You know, there's going to be some movies delayed and TV shows delayed and so forth. But you know what? That's a small price to pay so that people can get paid. See, there's the thing that set me off on this and the reason I wanted to talk about it was the quote. Did you see this from Deadline where an unnamed executive said, "The end game is to allow things to drag on until union members start losing their apartments and losing their houses."
Yeah.
And then forcing them back to work. That is disgusting. We will financially ruin you before we can financially ruin you.
Yeah. I mean, they're already financially ruining them. Yeah. So it's a double down.
Yeah. And keep in mind, exactly what you were just talking about. It's the small independent workers who do work for hire kind of thing. And you get that, you know, people say, well, these actors make millions of dollars.
I mean, some of them.
Yeah. Brad Pitt does.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Cruise does.
But that's not the point. That's not why the strike is happening. The strike is for the, you know, the industry minimum workers.
Right.
The ones you see in the background, the ones you see.
Right.
The character actors. They're not making, you know.
People who do little bit parts on Law and Order or something like that, you know,
that's the point. That's the point of this. That is what it's all about. And it's like, it's really weird how people like immediately focus on the most wealthy who are striking, not for their own benefit, but for the benefit of those who make less money for them. What a novel concept.
Exactly. And then you got, you know, I could go off on my little Marxist rant, but I'm not. I mean, bottom line, pay your
I think people. Groucho got paid okay.
I could go off on my Lenin rant, but, you know, I think John did okay as well.
Right.
Anyway, just, you know, be fair to people. Why does it have to be so hard?
And comic book fans being known as the sort of even-tempered and folks that we are, I'm sure we'll not fuss too strongly when their shows are delayed a little bit just so somebody can make a living wage.
Right. Everyone's on the same page, as it were.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's talk about something fun, which is, maybe you know more about this than I do, but Image is going to be putting out a Universal Monsters series about Dracula. That is, and that in and of itself is kind of cool, to do a comic based on the Universal Monsters. But the reason that this is exciting to me is it's going to be done by James Tynion IV and Martin Simmons. It's got a weird N and a D in there. Yeah. Simmons. It's not Simmons. It's Simmons. Anyway, they're the ones who did Department of Truth together, right, which is phenomenal. So
hope it comes back.
I hope so too.
But no, when I first saw this news, I was like, you're the first person I thought of, Paul. And so it's kind of bigger than just that, right? I mean, it's a Skybound, which is Robert Kirkman's kind of imprint, acquired the rights to all of the Universal Monsters.
But nothing else has been announced.
Nothing else has been announced, but I think there's going to be, I mean, and people are like, well, people have been doing Frankenstein and Dracula, blah, 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 forever. And no, but it's the Universal imaging of those, like the Bela Lugosi and the Boris Karloff. And it's the iconic sort of that other comic book companies can't use that Kirkman now will be able to do. He has access to all of that.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, just branding the comic Universal Monsters Dracula.
Right.
Which is, you know, it kind of implies that there's going to be more of that, which I think is fantastic. Player. I mean, those are iconic just looks of those characters. Right. When you think of Dracula, you think of Bela Lugosi. You know, I mean, to me,
you're the monster guy.
I know. I grew up watching those movies and they are, you know, hot chocolate on a snowy day for me. I have the box set of all those movies, all of them, literally all of them, all the way up to Abbott and Costello. And
some of the Abbott Costello ones, I'm sorry, I watched those with my dad as a kid. You know what I'm talking about, Sunday afternoons or Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
And the Abbott and Costello ones are fantastic as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe they're not. I don't care. In my mind, they always will be.
Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is an absolute cinematic classic. There is one scene, always makes me laugh. Dracula has Lou Costello under hypnosis and says, I will allow you to choose the manner of your death. And he says, good, old age, please. Great joke. That doesn't really do well when you explain it, but...
Well, no, but it's...
Yeah, but it's very funny. It's very funny.
And we get some of this is a little hokey, you know, it's... But
It is definitely... These are movies that are definitely of their time. The pacing is a bit slower. There's not... The acting is different. There's a different style of acting back then. So you have to actually get yourself into that mindset to enjoy these films. I love them, though. I just, like I said, I can watch them over and over again.
To me, it's like I still, like the black and white, I would rather watch an Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein in black and white than some of the CGI, over CGI'd stuff that's out there.
Oh, well, the James Whale movies, you know, Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. James Whale. Oh, and Invisible Man. James Whale was just brilliant. He used that German expressionism.
Of Gods and Monsters.
Yes. But the German expressionism and the harsh shadows and just his, you know, dramatic and comedic styles kind of mixed together.
And I feel like Kirkman and Tiny Onion will
Tiny Onion.
Well, that's the name of his company.
I know. It's fantastic. I still think it's funny.
I think we'll do, I feel like those two in particular will do a good job with the property. Yeah. Who knows? We'll see. But,
well, just the covers have been released and they look awesome. If nothing else, the visuals are going to be great. As you say, Tiny Onion, he does a pretty good job of writing the comics.
Yeah. He's all right.
Yeah, he does okay. So anyway, I'm very excited about that. And like a good thing is a common, we don't have to talk about sad, depressing things all the time. do you want to talk about the Superman casting or no?
I don't care. I mean, it doesn't affect
well, you have the marvelous Ms. Maisel connection.
Oh, you mean that? Oh, yeah, no. Rachel Brosnahan is Lois Lane. Thumbs up.
Absolutely. And apparently, I forget who he's cast as now.
I don't really know anything about the guy that's playing Superman.
I don't either. Apparently, he's very good.
Okay with it.
I've heard people raving about him, so it's very good. But Nathan Fillion has been cast as Guy Gardner, the Green Lantern Guy Gardner, right, which is just perfect. I know you said that you don't really have a Nathan Fillion connection.
No, I haven't really watched
Firefly.
I know people. I know people really enjoy him.
Yes, I am one of those people. Yeah. Not just Firefly, which of course
negative feelings about him whatsoever.
Yeah. He has the Firefly connection, and I didn't watch all of Castle, but I watched a decent amount of it. And then, you know, he has been in every James Gunn movie ever made. So,
So I have seen him in things. I know who he is. I think I know him best from his guest appearances in Big Mouth.
There you go. If nothing else, he's got Big Mouth, which is a weird thing to say. No, he's just one of those charming. He's like a Bruce Campbell. You know, he shows up in something and you say, that was fun. He's, I like him, that kind of a thing. But just casting him as Guy Gardner, first of all, he'll be perfect in it. And just to know that his friend, James Gunn, one of the best things in my career was putting Nathan Fillion in a bowl cut. This is wonderful.
Well, and I just had like a great connection. So you're going to have Rachel Brosnahan as Lois Lane, right? And that's an Amy Sherman Palladino show, or she's best known for that. And then, because it's James Gunn, we're going to have Sean Gunn.
Oh, yeah.
Who was in Gilmore Girls and Amy Sherman Palladino joint. Look at me connecting. And I'm sure some of our readers are just thinking, so this dude's a Maisel Gilmore Girls fan. And I will say, yes. Yes, yes. I am. Thank you.
I have never seen Gilmore Girls. I'm sorry.
And that's okay.
It's a Gilmore-sized hole in my life.
I've never seen Nathan Fillion shows.
There you go. I think we're done with the whole topic thing.
Well, there we go.
It wasn't really comprehensive or anything. It's just sort of us going, hey, this thing's happening.
We were Chris Farley-ing it for a bit.
Yeah, I love it when we do that. Remember that time we Chris Farley'd? That was so cool.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. Let's take a break and come back and talk about some Dark Turtles.
And we're back. So, Paul, today you and I are discussing a comic book that neither of us recommended.
That's right.
This is a listener recommendation, which is awesome. We love listener recommendations. Please feel free to recommend things to us. I think we have one that we've been dancing around that hopefully we get to eventually. But we're doing one, I believe, from not just a listener, but I believe a coworker of yours. Would you like to tell us about this, Paul?
What? Tell you about my coworker?
Well, you could tell us about your coworker.
it's Emily. Emily, this is for you. In the early 80s, a couple of struggling artists, Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird, made a sketch of four turtles, each holding a different ninja-style weapon. As a joke, Eastman titled the drawing Ninja Turtles, and just for fun, Laird added Teenage Mutant above it. And thus, though they didn't know it at the time, a multi-million dollar franchise was created. Using $1,200 borrowed from an uncle and a tax refund, Eastman and Laird created a company called Mirage Studios. Called that because the studios didn't actually exist, they just worked out of their living room. And they began creating comics and fleshing out the characters they created. At first, they were heavily inspired by current comics at the time, significantly Daredevil. Where Daredevil fought the Hand, the Turtles fought the Foot. Daredevil's teacher was Stick, the Turtles was Splinter. And they even went so far as to tie the origin of Daredevil into the origin of the Turtles. But the concept quickly went far beyond mere influence and homage, and soon became something really unique and all its own. Those original comics were black and white, more violent and mature than what it was to become. And what it was to become was a multimedia global juggernaut. comics, toys, cartoons, animated as well as live action movies, food products, and so much more. They became, to put it mildly, a big deal. Despite the success, Eastman and Laird were never shy about the fact that they didn't like that the characters had softened and been made more kid-friendly. They bemoaned the fact that the Turtles didn't yell damn anymore, and instead yelled easily marketable catchphrases like cowabunga and turtle power. So in 2022, Eastman and Laird returned to the TMNT franchise to write a darker tale, The Last Ronin. Set in a dystopian New York, it follows Michelangelo, the last surviving mutant turtle, no longer teenage, as he attempts to take down Oroku Hirato, the grandson of the original Shredder, and end his tyrannical reign of terror. He's aided in this mission by an older April O'Neil and her daughter Casey Marie, who may have something in common with Michelangelo other than a love of martial arts. Based on an original idea by Eastman and Laird, the story was fleshed out with the help of Tom Waltz, who wrote the majority of the IDW run of the Turtles. In addition, The Last Ronin is brought to life with an array of talented artists, Esau and Isaac Escorza, Ben Bishop, and Kevin Eastman himself. They fill the story with dynamic and fast-paced action rendered with cyberpunk aesthetics mixed with epic Kurosawa-esque samurai visuals. The art is beautiful and brutal, but it also helps accentuate the quieter moments of the story that are full of sadness and loss and regret, but also tenderness and hope and subtle humor. And although The Last Ronin is filled with callbacks and Easter eggs from decades of comics and cartoons, it never feels overwhelming, and you never feel lost if, like me, you're not up to speed on 30-plus years of continuity. Just the opposite, really. The Last Ronin immerses you in its world, makes you care for the characters, makes you feel the pain of their loss, and will have you tense with anticipation when they rally for one last stand. For longtime fans of the franchise, this story will no doubt be a satisfying culmination of years of storytelling. And for those of us new to the franchise, well, I'll admit that in the past, I've never read or even seen much of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle oeuvre, and I would never have considered myself a fan, but after reading The Last Ronin, I think that might change. Brian, what did you think of The Last Ronin?
Well, I think that was a great intro because that says kind of what I've been thinking. I'm the same. And what's funny is you and I have discussed in the not too distant past, going back and trying to find those early Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comics to maybe talk about.
Right. This had been a subject that popped up a few times.
Because I remember I got some of those early Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comics. Now, I think I got reprints. Because by the time, you know, I was in high school, probably high school, well, late junior high, maybe early high school. I'm trying to think when I was first starting to grab those. And so I think they were reprints because they had blown up, but there weren't that many out there. But I remember them being really, really, really dark. Definitely not kid friendly. Or, I mean, when I say kid friendly, I mean, I'm thinking about those, like the Cowabunga years. Where it was directly marketed to kids.
Right. You know, Nickelodeon. That's what the series ad aired on Nickelodeon. It was directly for a very young demographic.
Yes.
And it was made very, very kid friendly. And, the love of pizza and all that came into it.
So like you, I haven't followed Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles at all. Like at all. I had to look up and figure out who was who and which mask matched. Character. I mean, that's how out of touch I am.
Yes. I didn't know who was who either.
Because I was how do you tell them apart? And I guess also, I mean, the weapons they use distinguishes them. And there is, depending on the writer, some writers do a really good job, some don't, of distinguishing by their voices.
Right. And, you know, in more recent years, again, doing research, the style, because they were pretty much drawn the same, you know, in those mid years.
Now
they're turtles, but there's been some differentiation now, like, you know, some like one's bigger, one's smaller, one's thinner.
Right.
So they're giving them each distinct profiles and so forth. But yeah,
I mean, novice, it's hard to see that.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, for me, this was hitting right when, like, these comics were coming out right when I was in high school and I was more concerned with, you know, girls and rock and roll than I was with comic books at the time. So I kind of missed
a different time.
Yeah, I missed the jumping on point. And then, of course,
those things were often viewed as being separate things.
Well, you and I, when we were, we've talked about this before, when we were in high school, being a nerd was not a good thing.
No.
Mm-mm. No. You know, if you liked comic books, you kept that on the down low.
I mean, sort of. I mean, I was a punk rock kid. You know, I went from, you know, a mohawk to the Robert Smith hair, or not specifically Robert Smith, but, you know, the Robert Smith meets Jesus and Mary Chain type. Anyway, nobody cares about what I look like in high school. But yeah, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, I was, you know, punk rock, college rock, but I was also very much an avid comic reader.
Yeah, well...
It wasn't like I had a friend. I think he listens occasionally to this podcast. Scott was his name, who he and I shared a love of comics as well. So shout out to Scott if he's listening. But yeah, it wasn't something, those two things didn't always mix.
Yeah. I mean,
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was not a way to get laid.
There you go. That's the way to say it. Yeah. So yeah, I had my gap years in my high school because pretended I didn't like comics. But then, you know, things change. You get into
it. But it actually could have been because there were a lot of women reading comics at the time, too. It wasn't acknowledged in geek culture.
It was, but it was seen in the mainstream as this is for kids. And if you read it, you were an adolescent baby man, you know, and you're a little self-conscious when you're in high school and you don't want people to, you try to avoid being picked on. At least I did.
And thank goodness that stigma, both the sort of misogynistic stigma around it, which wasn't fair because it, like, all of that stigma has been largely stripped away.
I mean, we still have a contingent of very loud but small people. Yeah,
we try to keep them behind the gate.
They keep getting out. Anyway, let's talk about The Last Ronin.
Yeah, so anyway, back to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. For all of that kerfufflage that I just did, man, I love this comic.
It's really good. I was so surprised, actually.
There are things, like you talked about Easter eggs, and there are things I didn't know. And so, like, a lot of these characters they're introducing, I don't know who Stockman was. I don't know who that weird robot head.
Honeycutt.
I keep wanting to call him BJ Honeycutt. I will not, but I keep wanting to do that. You know, I'm like, I don't know. I don't have a history with any of these characters, but it didn't matter.
Exactly. When there's a scene when, I mean, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles have been in the pop culture world for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So even if I wasn't watching the cartoons or reading the comics, I knew who April O'Neil was. I knew who Casey Jones is.
Right.
You know, I know who Bebop and Rocksteady are, even though they're not in this particular comic, and Splinter and Shredder and all that. You know, so I know these things. But again, mm-hmm. when that April goes to a safe and pulls out Honeycutt's head, and I said, oh, I bet that's important. I don't understand the significance of this. But it didn't matter.
It doesn't give you enough. So I figured it out without having to. I may have Wikipedia'd at some point, but reading the comic, which I decided I was going to read blind without stopping to research anything. You know, the first time I read it, I'm like, I'm reading this as a piece. But they explained enough that I got the context.
Exactly. And they give you enough flashback, just a hint of it to say, okay, I get this. You know, you figure out, like, they introduce Stockman and I'm like, okay, I don't know who that is. But then throughout the context of the story, you go, oh, okay, they obviously have some history with him that I am unaware of. However, I get his deal.
Right.
He's a tech dude. He hates these guys. And same thing with Honeycutt the robot. It's like, oh, I get it. He's helped them in the past. I'm really kind of impressed by this.
Right. They didn't. I think there was even a mash, like I made the BJ Honeycutt, but I think in the comic there's a callback to that, because I think at one point one of them calls him Dr. Honeycutt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You said that was a joke, and it's like, oh yes, and a very funny one too. But yeah, I just you know, it gives you, it doesn't pander and over explain, like saying, oh, this is who this is, and gives you all the backstory. It gives you just enough so that you can keep reading and get it. I think it's great.
Yeah, I really enjoy this comic. I was curious what you were going to think, because knowing your love for a certain Daredevil writer and artist, because the very first note I wrote down when reading this was Frank Miller.
Well, the original run of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comics was dedicated to Frank Miller and Jack Kirby for their influence. And this one is as well. And look, I may not particularly care for Frank Miller, especially in his later years. I do understand his importance and his significance into the development of comics, especially Daredevil and Wolverine and just, you know, early comics. He's important. Oh, I guess the Batman thing too. I don't know.
I guess he had a comic about Batman that's
yeah, it's been read a few times, I guess. No, I understand and appreciate Frank Miller. I don't have to love him, you know. But it's fine. People took influence. I mean, these guys obviously took a hell of a lot of influence from Daredevil, which I find really fun myself.
Right.
I love the fact that they fight the foot instead of the hand, or Splinter instead of Stick. That's clever.
It started off as a dark parody. Yeah, which again, you covered in your intro. I'm not saying anything that you haven't already. It's very blatant.
Well, in the original...
That's okay, because it was intended to be blatant.
Yeah. It's a parody, I don't know, homage, I guess. But in the original, in the origin of the original Turtles, it is Daredevil. You know, Daredevil gets hit by this truck where are these vials of radioactive MacGuffin falls on him. But in the Turtles, you see a kid getting hit by these vials, and one of them bounces off his head and into the sewers, where it lands on some turtles. And that's how they get their origin. So Daredevil and the Turtles, has there been a crossover between Daredevil and the Turtles? Probably should have researched that before I asked.
I'm going to fail here as the resident Daredevil person. I don't think so. If there had been, it would not have... If I had seen that was happening, that would not have been what I would consider like a completist moment from my Daredevil collection.
Yes.
So I may not have paid attention to it.
Yeah. Well, Marvel with their crossover stinginess.
I think maybe. DC has had more crossover with like IDW, which has had that property for a long time.
Yeah. I saw, and I only skimmed it. I didn't actually read the whole thing. It was a crossover with the X-Files and... and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So it has the, you know, the lone gunman, those three guys who helped out Mulder. It's them investigating these sightings of, you know, human-sized turtles. It's fun.
Oh, I'm going to have to look that up now. Yeah, I would read that.
So the comic itself, like you had mentioned, I don't know how we can talk about the issues. There's a lot of fighting, but I don't know how deep and intense we're going to get into this. But anyway, that being said.
There's not a lot of, I want to say depth, and I don't mean that pejoratively. There is, let's start with the art. Some of the IDW art is not great.
It's okay.
It's serviceable. IDW has artists that come in and they do their job and they present. And, I'm thinking of all the Star Trek series on IDW, which I really enjoy, but the art often is real serviceable.
Right. It's just there to provide some visuals. It's not there to wow.
But this art is really quite good.
Oh my God, it's great. And I love the fact that you have the main storyline,
right,
which that art is brilliant. But then you get the flashbacks, and it's done in two different styles. Eastman actually does the flashbacks to Japan, where it's in that more rough
black and white
pencil style.
Almost like woodblock.
Exactly. Yeah. And that just adds a great tone and feel to it. And it differentiates the different timelines. And because then you have the little sepia toned, more cartoonish look when you're doing the kind of 90s, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's the flashback to, so these are, we're referencing like several things that are like kind of the really interesting things to talk about, like thematically in this, and that comes with a difference in art, like you were just saying. I mean, plot-wise, generically, we could just do a generic plot overview, right? Because the plot isn't that complex.
Oh, no.
Yeah, which is fine. It didn't need to be.
Yeah, it is a straight up samurai storyline.
You know? Michelangelo, like the other Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, have been killed, and we find out how at various points with those flashbacks throughout the series. So Michelangelo is the last surviving Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. He's coming into New York, and he's going to kill
Oroku Horato.
That guy. he's coming to get his revenge after 16 years. And then at some point he meets up with April and April's daughter, Casey. They team up and then succeed in their mission. I'm not giving anything away. Revenge has gotten.
Yes. Revenge has had.
Yes. And that's the plot.
Yeah.
The generic overall plot. There's a lot of interesting things that happen within it.
Well, yeah, and one of the most, you know, the primary themes, I guess, is the, you know, regret and grief and survivor guilt. They mentioned that several times in the story about Michelangelo he feels bad that he has lived where his brothers and his father have died. He wasn't there to save them. He feels bad that he should have
PTSD like nobody's business.
Yeah, to the point where that first issue, my goodness. It's action-packed all the way through. So you have Michelangelo entering into New York and he's storming the castle and he has these visions of his brothers basically berating him the whole time. They're his Jiminy Cricket Turtle. Jiminy Turtles. And and it's just some of the action is just brilliant.
Oh, it's so good. The art is so good. And one of the things in my notes is like for the first issue, I'm like action, action, action. Almost nonstop.
Yeah, well, there's so much action, and then I remember there's one page. It's almost a splash page of Michelangelo standing at the top of these stairs, and all the way down the stairs, you just see dead bodies.
Yeah,
They didn't show you him killing them all, but you got it from the previous pages. You know what he did, and it's just so good. It's amazing.
I mean, that first issue is one of the finest. I'm going to say it is one of the finest first issues of a comic I've read in a long time.
I'm there with you. I agree. And then it ends because he fails. He doesn't, through various things, he doesn't actually get to kill Hirato. So he falls off a building. He's terribly injured. And he decides to kill himself, ritually kill himself.
Yes.
And you're in Chicago. It's Harry Carey. Which is just, it's so dark. He lays out all the weapons, his brother's weapons and Splinter's notebook. Mm-hmm. And he apologizes and he's about to kill himself, but can't quite bring himself to do it. Maya, man, that was dark.
And then he gets rescued by Steampunk Girl.
Gets rescued by Steampunk Girl.
Being Steampunk Girl in the next issues.
Oh, my favorite Dead Milkman song.
Punk Rock Girl.
Steampunk Girl. So we find out later that, you know, there's a lot of toying around, but her name is, yeah, you know, he's rescued by Casey, who happens to be the daughter of April O'Neil and Casey Jones. And she's that typical, lot of energy, talented, but a loose cannon.
She's, yeah.
She doesn't have any discipline. There's actually
watched out for because you don't know whether she's going to where she's going to like go off. Yeah,
right. There's one. I mean, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I just love this one scene where Michelangelo at one point during a fight tells her to stay put. That he goes off and he gets in a lot of danger. And she comes in and saves him. And he said, "I thought I told you to stay put." And she said, "Yeah, I didn't listen." And Michelangelo's like, and Michelangelo says, "Terrible discipline, excellent initiative." And I just love that. That's what I was talking about. Like, there's humor in this. The humor is subtle, but it's really good. It's not like the fast paced banter that they have in the comic, the cartoons and films. And I don't know if you've ever seen any of the Michael Bay Turtles movies.
I think all you need to say is I've never seen anything Michael Bay.
Yes. Well, I've watched clips from that. I couldn't stomach watching the whole thing, but it's just nonstop.
I would like real quickly to make a public service announcement here. There is no pizza present in this entire comic book.
No. Apparently Eastman and Laird, that's one of the things they were not happy about. Because, you know, they created this thing and of course they sold the rights to various companies to make toys and things in it. And I'm sure they don't say no or they don't bemoan the royalty checks coming their way. But, you know, they had their idea and other people took it in different directions that they didn't necessarily think it should have gone in, right. Which is fine. Stuff happens when you sell your characters to somebody else, they're going to do other stuff with it.
Yeah, I would. One other note is, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that Michelangelo was actually intending to commit harikari and he only failed because he passed out.
He
decided not to.
I think it could be read that way, but he's also, some of the dialogue he says, at one point he says, not like this. And then he passes out. So I took it as he couldn't bring himself to do it.
Okay.
But I could totally see where he was going to, but just couldn't didn't have the strength to. I don't know. Either way, it works for me.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, like, it was interesting, the two different interpretations of that.
I think that's probably intentional, because as crazy as it sounds that, you know, there's a giant man-sized turtle trying to fight a cyberpunk samurai villain. but there is some ambiguity in this, believe it or not.
Well, I think there's a lot of ambiguity. You know, one of the themes, like I have several themes written down, and like one of the themes I have is, so he spends a lot of time in this first comic, which we've alluded to, and then in future ones, talking to his brothers. And it is presented artistically as him actually having the dialogue, like the brothers are there and he's having this dialogue with his brothers. And like we said, you know, is it PTSD? Is it or is he just completely lost his mind?
Little column A, little column B.
Yeah. So yeah. Even that's not made completely clear. Yeah. You know, someone could argue that, you know, no, they're really talking to him from beyond. And maybe they are. That's an interpretation someone could have. It's certainly not one I had.
No. And I think because several characters comment on the fact that who are you talking to?
Right. Yeah. So he's talking to self or right. Talking to the people in his head.
Yeah. And finally, when he comes, you know, he comes to grips with himself, he tells them to go away. You know, it's very much like Gollum Smeagol. He's a Lord of the Rings reference. But yeah, I know you love them.
Well, there's less walking and singing songs in this comic book than...
Yes, and that is what it's missing. Could have been made so much better by long, long...
50 pages of walking.
Yes, and then a few poems. Anyway, Lord of the Rings is great. Let's move on.
The sigh.
But yeah, so you get some good stuff, like April O'Neil, who, again, you know, the cartoons and movies kind of they turned her into a reporter who tried to follow them around. Again, Eastman and Laird didn't really care for that, so they brought her back to her origins of just this scientific badass, basically.
Yeah, the memory I had of her was just she was part of the team, like somehow she had, through a wacky set of circumstances, they had become friends, and she was just their human pal, along with her boyfriend, Casey, who was a vigilante as well.
No, he was a vigilante, and then, see, again, this comes from my limited knowledge of 30 years of comic books, my understanding is that April was more of a kind of scientist, mechanic, engineer, brilliant person who would help them fix stuff and figure stuff out, which is why in this, she's taking blood samples, and she's creating huge tank-like vehicles.
The tank is awesome.
The tank is awesome. Yeah, so I mean, so the idea is that Harato has, with the help of Stockman's technology, basically subjugated the people of New York, so that it's the full on dystopian: the rich live high up, and the rock bottom are all the poor people. But of course, there's a little rebellion brewing underneath that just needed that little spark, and then in comes a badass mutagen ninja turtle.
A mutant ninja turtle.
Yes.
An adult mutant ninja turtle.
Yes. An adult. So apparently he's getting stronger as he gets older, which I like that particular detail.
Because he was so, I did eventually do a little, so he was kind of like, he was the more agile of the group, right? Each of the four had their specialties.
Yeah.
Like Donatello was the technical one. Leonardo was the leader and the strong one. Raphael, I can't remember, but yeah, I mean, Michelangelo was kind of the fun-loving one, right?
Yeah, he was the quippy one who was just sort of, you know, having a good time.
Just like the real life Michelangelo.
Exactly. He also painted ceilings from time to time, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like the fact that they chose Michelangelo because he was the fun-loving one, who's now lost everything, and including his, I guess, whimsy.
Right.
Yeah, I like that. He sort of gets his, he starts to find himself back. He gets his old self back a little bit in this by meeting up with April, and just so happy that, you know, he has a friend that's still alive, which that's happy and sad at the same time.
Right. It's a reunion of sorts. So he and of course, April is missing limbs.
because
and we find out all about this. I don't know if we want to talk about.
I think there are two major flash. There are several flashbacks, but there's two major flashbacks, I think, that are significant.
Yeah, I think they're really important.
Exactly. There's one. The first one is kind of an attack by Stockman on the Turtles, where they're trying, you know, the Turtles are trying to get Honeycutt to safety and basically get out of the way of all the, because Stockman has all this technology.
This is where we find out how he becomes the last Ronin is through these flashbacks.
There's a very large, a battle ensues and Stockman realizes he's not going to win. So he just blows everybody up. Now, Michelangelo does manage to get clear, but everyone else dies, including Casey Jones and Leonardo.
There's an earlier flashback where Raphael dying is because he loses his shit.
Yeah, and he's the hothead, and he goes in by himself.
After the woman, Karai, am I saying that right? She's not really a major part of, well, she is sort of, but so we had the first flashback where they'd been attacked and Raphael hot-headedly goes after her and the woman that's the head of the foot at the head of the foot. And they have a big battle and it's a pretty vicious battle and he ends up getting there in the water. He gets stabbed and killed in the water or he drowns in the water. So that's the first flashback where Raphael dies. So then we come back to the one you're talking about.
Exactly. And there's an explosion and that takes out what Michelangelo thinks is everyone else, because Splinter and Donatello had gone off to Japan to talk to the foot about a peace treaty. So they're not there, but so Casey Jones dies. He thinks April dies, but she actually lost an arm and a leg.
Cost her an arm and a leg.
Yeah, and he thinks everyone died there, so he runs off as quickly as he can to Japan to tell them it's a ruse.
Donatello
and Splinter. That it's just a ruse and the peace treaty is just putting them in danger, which leads us to this really cool standoff. I think what in the guise of, like I said, they're going to be doing peace negotiations and sign a treaty, but it's really just a setup.
Right. It's Clan Hamato.
Yes. And Clan Hamato and Clan Oroku.
Right. Whenever I hear Clan Hamato, to be honest, every time I would read it, I thought that was like a clam dish.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Clamato. It's a beer with
tomato juice. Yes, that's what I'm thinking of, is Clamato. It's yeah. So anyway, carry on.
But we get this really great, I think, a great scene. It's set in a graveyard. And, you know, obviously something's a little bit off and Splinter is feeling it. And then it all comes to a head where I'm breezing over some details here. But
Clamato is betrayed. They think they're there for a peace treaty.
Yes.
And it turns out it's a trap.
It's a trap. So Hirato sends off all these foot soldiers. Foot soldiers?
Huh. They're the foot soldiers. There's a gag song in there somewhere.
They're foot foots. Yes. And that's just this really great battle with, Splinter proving why he's a master. I just love this battle scene, this fight scene. But unfortunately,
me and Leo are kicking ass.
Is it Leo or Donatello? I'm sorry.
Yes, it's Donatello. I'm sorry.
I get so confused.
Yeah.
But anyway, they are kicking ass, and there's Donatello with all these arrows in his shell. It's really cool. I mean, the art is fantastic, and the action is beautiful and well paced. It's just great. But sadly, Splinter and Donatello are killed in the battle. Michelangelo arrives a little bit too late, and he gets told this story, and that's when he decides. First,
he
wanders off into the mountains in complete grief until he just gets full of rage. And, you know, his whole life will just be revenge from there on in.
Well, he's seen his friends blow up in the building, and then he gets to Japan too late to save his other friends. Wanders off into the mountain as a turtle in the freezing cold.
Not a good move.
And has a battle with some kind of another group of bad guys. And he slaughters them.
Yeah. I don't even think they're bad guys. Well, they're assholes is what it is. Yeah. He's just there doing his turtle stuff, kind of trying to make a life for himself. And they say, oh, look, he's a freak. Let's kill it. Yeah. He just eviscerates them. But that's when he decides he will be Johnny Ronin revenge.
And then he engages in a 16-year planning of his revenge.
Where he learns every martial art ever. This is the, if this were a movie, this is the montage.
Yes.
Yeah, the training scene.
Yeah, the flashbacks are set over various issues. We don't get the full story.
And I say the structure is perfect. They give you just enough information.
We don't get it all at once, and we see it slowly built up via flashbacks over the series. Yeah.
So we finally get the whole backstory. We know Michelangelo's motivation. Now we come to two major battles to end off this story. One is the assault on Stockman's Island. The Stockman's still alive, but he's more machine than man. Yeah. So and then there's this really great battle. That's where the scene happens of, you know, terrible discipline, nice initiative. Yeah, he had been now. So, and you know, I guess we forgot to say that he's Michelangelo, that is, has been training Casey. And now he is the sensei.
It's a really nice scene where, you know, she acknowledges Casey, the 16-year-old daughter of April, and the other Casey calls him sensei.
And gives him a nice little hug. And it is revealed that Casey has the mutagen in her. So she has enhanced strength and healing abilities. I thought for a moment that this was going to get real creepy. One of the turtles had relations with April.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, but it didn't go in that direction. I was like, okay, thanks guys. I don't think
they really strongly insinuated that.
When you have April's daughter also has, you know, turtle stuff in her. I was like, oh, this is going to go in a direction I don't want to know. I don't want to do. But they did not go there. So thank you, writers. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it was explained as it was the exposure that April and Casey had to the turtles over time.
And she had done experiments with the mutagen. That's what they call it.
Right.
So, so she's been exposed to it over a long period of time. So she passed it along. Yeah.
Yeah. Great insane battle to get into Stockman's place, because what they wanted to do was shut down the power grid. So Stockman was in charge of the power grid.
Yes, and he's using all his crazy tech to subjugate the people, basically.
And Hirota was using Stockman's power grid to help control the populace. And so the idea was they were going to like invade Stockman's place first to shut down the power grid. And this is where BJ Honeycutt came into play.
Yes.
Apparently there's history between Stockman and BJ Honeycutt.
Yes.
I should stop calling him BJ.
It's fine. You can call him Ted Farrell. Is that his name? Is that his name? I don't even know
about, but I got enough of it to understand the animosity between the two. And so Honeycutt was used. So the idea was to invade Stockman's fortress and somehow put the head of Honeycutt, the robot Honeycutt, somewhere where it could take over the power grid, which it did.
Yeah, you basically have his consciousness take over the power grid using nanotechnology. Just put nano in front of it and everything's fine.
Yeah. And success.
And success. They did it. They shut everything down. Hirata only has, he doesn't have, because there were some cyber.
Lots of cyber ninjas. There's a RoboCop. By the way, we have to acknowledge that early on in this, there are RoboCop ninjas. Yes,
there are RoboCop. Well, synthetic they look ninjas. Like
RoboCop and they're ninjas.
Like it's synthetic ninjas, which they start calling Sinjas. Again, in my cursory research, so the cartoons changed all the human fighters into robots that way. Kid friendly, so you're killing robots instead of killing people. Eastman and Laird didn't care for that. That's why they retained the robots, but they put people inside them. So yeah, so you still got the brutality, and you're still keeping continuity. Yeah, good for them. Anyway, the power grid shut down, all the singes are deactivated, and now they can attack the Tower Hiroto.
And they say, you know, at the end of this is at the end of the fourth issue of five, where they're like, you know, we won the battle, not the war.
And now, here comes the war. Of course, being the last Ronin, Michelangelo doesn't want to put anyone else in danger, so he sneaks off and goes to fight Hiroto himself.
Leaving his journal behind.
We get a weird thing where the sewers start to flood.
Yeah, that was... I know like narratively, I know what that why that happened, and that was to have like an April and Casey moment.
Yes, and it added a ticking clock to the whole thing so that it makes everything more tense. But ultimately, it kind of goes nowhere because
that was the one thing in all of this that I found weird.
Yeah,
so Casey wasn't necessary. Okay, the sewers are flooding. We'll just get out.
But Casey's or April's down in there, and Casey goes to save her. She gets down there, but April has a mask on, like a underwater breathing apparatus. So she's fine.
So Casey went through all of this, like almost drowning to save her mom, even though her mom's just sitting there with a breathing apparatus. It was weird.
It was a little strange.
Thing that I found to be narratively a little, but I also understand why it's there. And it's about those two. It's keeping them off the board as Michelangelo, right? So he can go solo.
Exactly. So, because at this point we've already established that Casey is not only, you know, has mutant powers, but she's also now a trained badass because Michelangelo has been training her
2 or 3 whole days.
Yeah. Well, you know, no, it's, you know, it's again, it's a montage. You learn a lot in a montage.
Yes.
I assume that several months had gone by. Actually, that's what it seemed to me.
Okay.
Yeah. If you had put her into the mix, then it wouldn't have been as dangerous because you had to have the final battle mano a mano. So Horatio actually puts on his shredder suit, which is an upgraded liquid metal version,
which is a nice 90s callback.
Yes, indeed.
Like, so, and I think, and I don't mean that poorly. I mean that like it was like the metal self-healing suit was so like image 1990s.
So yeah, we get this really great final battle between the two main heroes, and
that goes on for pages and pages and pages, and you're never bored by it.
No, not at all. And you feel Michelangelo just gets pummeled, and you feel him, you know, getting hurt and struggling. And he, of course, he has his inner monologue where he's saying, okay, I gotta slow down. I gotta try a new tactic, you know, and you see him learning and evolving his styles to try to fight basically the new Shredder. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's just great. I have no other words for it than that.
It's widescreen. And when I say widescreen, I am referencing sort of the Wildstorm of, you know, the Mark Millar authority Stormwatch kind of widescreen, but not in the same way. It's so well done.
It's fantastic. It's a wonderful action scene. I mean, this would be the, you know, the set piece of an action film. And of course, you know, Michelangelo, he keeps getting more and more hurt, but he keeps battling on, and he finally finds Horatio's weakness and takes him down. But in doing so, he has killed himself.
Yes.
He didn't kill himself. He himself was killed. Yet. He completed his mission. He has fulfilled his Ronin-ness.
Yes.
And saved his family honor and, you know, basically freed the, well, I was going to say the world, but New York City.
At least New York. We don't know about
that. Well, if you're in New York, they think they're the world. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah. So, I mean, he basically reached that carry on my wayward son moment. Horatio dies immediately, but Michelangelo luckily stays alive long enough for him to have, you know, the emotional heart-to-heart with Casey.
And it's good. It's very sweet. She brings him the journal back and says, here's your journal. You know, and this is a little corny, but I kind of liked it. Where on the last page of that journal, Michelangelo had scrolled no peace, as in N-O peace.
Yeah.
But before he left, he put K-N. O-W, no peace, and gave that back to Casey. I know, again, little corny, little on the nose, but
but
I like it.
Well, we have to remember that, like, when he dies, he gets to join his brothers. You know, there's a nice little moment, again, that sepia-toned, where he is there now with his brothers, and they're doing their brother stuff, and...
And Splinter is there, and Casey Jones is there. And
Yeah.
So he's in Ninja Turtle Heaven.
Yeah, Ninja Turtle Heaven, whatever that is.
And it's sweet. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the ultimate denouement, we get April and Casey in their lab with a new set of turtles that they have given the mutagen to, hoping that they will grow up to be new adolescent mutant Ninja Turtles.
Adolescent radioactive hamsters? Yes. That was a comic too, right? But and that's a little weird to me.
Well, there is a
little, there's a little experimentation. I understand the point of it.
Yeah, it's supposed to be sweet.
Yes,
it's, you know.
Yeah,
it's...
they're feeding the turtles and the little baby turtles. And
yes, old Yeller had puppies. It's fine.
Right, ethically, where are we ethically on this?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter.
It's supposed to be a sweet ending.
An ethical argument about the ending of a comic book.
And there is a sequel to this following the new Turtles. So
yes, I did see that, and now I have not read. I didn't read anything before. I didn't read anything after. I wanted to just read the source material for this.
But overall, man, I enjoyed the hell out of this. I've read it a few times now, and I mean, for this podcast, I've had to read it a couple of times, and boy, it's great. It's just really good.
Yeah, this is really good comics.
So I say, thank you, Emily. Hat tip.
Yeah.
To you. Boy, oh boy. I would not have read this if it wasn't for that. That wasn't for that recommendation. Wow. Good job. This was great.
Yeah. And this is why people should keep sending us recommendations.
Absolutely. Please do that. I don't always respond because I'm me. but it's not like I don't see your comments and comments and recommendations. So please bring them on. But yeah, I guess that's it. I mean, I got nothing more on this other than go out and read this. It's awesome.
I cannot, it's still hard for me to wrap my head around how much I enjoyed a comic book in 2023 called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I know, right? At first I was a little hesitant when Emily, when she recommended this to me, I was just sort of like, oh, okay. Sure, this is the one you want? And she said, yes.
And, great recommendation.
Great recommendation. My trepidation or terrapination was unfounded. And this was really great. I'm so happy I read it. I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Go out and read Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Last Ronin. And I'm actually going to go hunt down some other turtles.
And I'm going to, now I'm going to investigate the sequel.
And there's also a Last Ronin Lost Years sequel as well. So I guess some of the stuff he did when he was in Japan. Again, I don't know, but looks cool.
And I'm assuming something will be, I mean, they left it open. So
yep, there's going to be more. So the next time on an all new edition of the Collect-Edition, it's going to be my pick.
Yes, it will be.
So let me just explain a little bit. What we are going to read is Doctor Who. Brian, are you excited to read a Doctor Who comic?
I can barely sit still.
So this is, what we're going to read is from 1980. And this was the, it's Marvel Comics, but it's the comics that were published in England.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a lot of great stuff.
Right. Yeah. So the way, I mean, this is weird. This is the reason I'm kind of hesitating. I'm not just throwing out what the title is, because these comics were done as backup strips in Doctor Who Weekly, which was a magazine that was put out about the series Doctor Who. And then they would have these comics in the back, and they're usually just a page long, but several pages, and over several issues, you would get a full thing. So anyway, long story short is there's not really a trade, or there are a trade, but there's so many in there. Anyway, I'm not explaining this well. I have picked out two stories that are sort of classic, and the two stories together will basically equal a trade. Does that sound good? Yeah, or basically, you know, what would be the equivalent of four issues of a comic?
All right.
So the stories we're going to read are City of the Damned and The Star Beast, and they're both sort of classic. If you're a Doctor Who fan, so much so that The Star Beast, which is about a little fluffy creature called Beep the Meep. I know this. Anyway, in the latest trailer for the new, there's going to be some Doctor Who specials later this year with David Tennant revising his role as the Doctor. And in the trailer that was released, it was a live action version of Beep the Meep. And I nearly lost my shit. And we're going to read it, Brian.
Yes, we are.
Okay, so this might pique your interest. Both of these stories were written by Pat Mills and John Wagner.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So you might know them from Judge Dredd in 2000 AD.
Uh-huh.
And they're all drawn by a very young up-and-comer named Dave Gibbons.
Never heard of him. Clearly, he hasn't done anything of note.
So these comics, they're not just Doctor Who. They are 2000 AD alum. Maybe that'll pique your interest a little bit.
I am I am fascinated.
Excellent. I'm excited because I love this franchise and I am really excited to make you read these.
That's where I thought you were. If someone doesn't know anything about Doctor Who, like at all, except that there was one guy that used to wear a funny scarf.
These stories will follow his adventures. That's the Doctor who is the head of who's in these comics. It's the fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, the long scarf guy.
And will we have to know any history of Doctor Who to be able to enjoy these?
No, you don't.
Excellent.
But if you do, it enhances it a little bit. But now you don't need to know.
Okay.
I'm very excited to hear what your thoughts are. Even if you hate it, I don't care. I just want to make you read Doctor Who. So after all that, that's what we're reading. City of the Damned and the Star Beast. Those two stories. And it's going to be a lot of fun. All right. So thanks, everybody, for listening. As always, send us your feedback. Let us know what you think. Go to our website, collecteditionpodcast.com. Start leaving comments there because I will admit I'm not on X as much as I used to be. So, and I never go to Facebook. So go to our website, collecteditionpodcast.com. You can leave comments on individual episodes. And then there's a little form you can fill out that if you want to recommend something. So do that. And there's also a contact form and
how nice we are to recommendations.
Absolutely. We've always been nice to our recommendations. We had Archie and we were nice to that. And we did Judge Dredd. That was a recommendation. We were nice to that. We're always nice.
We are.
We're awesome. Cowabunga, dude. Turtle power. So,
Jojo.
Until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?